Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Amelia Drake about ears, tonsils, and sinus infections in children.
That would probably be like snot and bacteria and things that you probably see a lot more than I do nowadays, Christy.
I do. I see it a lot in my family with my young children and certainly a lot in my pediatric patients.
Well, I know that a lot of our listeners probably have children and grandchildren that this will be appropriate for, so looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have some really interesting and diverse sorts of research that I think matters to a lot of listeners.
I would agree with that. This first one is about people who have had a heart attack and their risk for committing suicide. Pretty astounding research.
Yeah, we've kind of known that the risk of becoming depressed and anxious after a heart attack, and a lot of people have heart attacks and blockages and get angioplasty nowadays, but that risk with depression and anxiety was higher. But could it actually result in the committing of suicide?
This was a study done in Denmark and published in the journal Circulation that found that in the immediate period after having a heart attack, the risk of suicide rises dramatically, particularly among people who have a history of mental illness. And those people are about 60 times more likely to commit suicide than people who did not have a heart attack and do not have mental illness.
Yeah, they followed over 20,000 people who had committed suicide and compared them to over 200,000 similar people that hadn't. And while the absolute number was, not as high, this relative increase was really striking. And the fact that, anxiety and depression from a heart attack could be so severe that it really pushes you to commit suicide, that it really should be entirely preventable.
It should be. And, I think we know there's this link between mental illness and chronic disease. But in this case, even for the patients with no history of mental illness or depression, the risk for suicide tripled in that month after a heart attack and remained higher for the next 5 years. So I don't know about you, Adam, but reading this really highlighted for me our need to screen patients better for depression or other mental illness when they've had a heart attack, and perhaps to incorporate that more formally in our rehabilitation programs.
Yeah, I wrote an article years ago in a textbook on post-heart attack rehabilitation care. And I was trying to think, I don't think I wrote about at that point in time really screening for and intervening for mental health at that time. I mean, we know things about sexual function, about return to work. All of these things really are important for people after they have a heart attack. But I think we have to intervene with programs that really screen for it, like you say, but also offer social support after you've had a heart attack to try to prevent this from happening.
Absolutely. Well, this next research is a little different. It's about alcoholism and programs that are on the internet that are set up to help people reduce their alcohol intake.
Yeah, this was appropriately in the journal called Addiction. Yes, there is a journal called Addiction. And really looking to what can we do and what do we know about how to help out the 17 million Americans who struggle with alcoholism. 17 million Americans.
That's profound. And this was done by British researchers. And it was one of those things that Adam and I sometimes talk about, a systematic review where they looked through all the medical literature for any studies on computer-based interventions to help people reduce their alcohol intake. And they found 16 good studies and combined that was over 5,600 participants.
Yeah, and they found that these studies, and they're all different types that they were probably using in the internet, because this is the internet age is not that all that old, particularly for studies to intervene on. But they found that these programs reduced people who have problem drinking by an average of what they say 26 grams per week. Well, let's say how much that is. That's 2 cans of beer a week, and that's not very bad. I mean, that's a lot considering that these are very low-cost programs.
And, I mean, just for a reference point, the Center for Disease Control, or the CDC, would define heavy drinking, and we talked about this once or twice on the program before, is for men, it's drinking more than 2 drinks per day, and for women, it's more than 1 drink per day on average would be a heavy drinker.
And, you know, I think there's a caveat here, Christy, which is that, you know, these studies were done in probably controlled research settings, and we know that they don't work quite as well in the real world. And so I think there needs to be more research done here. I would love to see better studies, more quality studies, studies done out in the primary care population. But the simple fact is we need to embrace the use of technology, low-cost technology, to help people make substantive life changes. And stopping the amount you drink when you're an alcoholic or cutting back is one of those life changes.
It sure is. And the next one is about teenagers. And this is about teenagers being prescribed more dangerous prescriptions, meaning prescriptions that are have the higher potential for abuse, like painkillers, sedatives, stimulants like Ritalin.
Yeah, you know, in 1994, 6% of teens received a prescription for these controlled medications. And this research looked at the changes over time. And by 2007, more than 11%, a doubling of the rate, up to 2.5 million doctor's visits a year in which these types of drugs were prescribed to teenagers. And this was reported in the journal Pediatrics.
And on the one hand, you think, well, Adam, maybe we're treating pain better, or maybe we've got more drugs that are available now to treat attention deficit disorder and that sort of thing. But the thing that's so concerning is we know that teenagers and young adults are more likely than any other group to abuse these things. So, I mean, the statistics are pretty profound. 1 in 8 teenagers and 1 in 3 adults in their 20s say that they've used prescription drugs just for fun or recreationally in their lifetimes.
In addition, the chances of these groups becoming addicted is higher.
It is.
And so the selling of the drugs, the use of the drugs, the addiction to the drugs, yes, they're probably being used appropriately for the conditions. But I think having the conversation right up front with your children, any listeners out there, we encourage you, have conversations. If you have a child that's being prescribed one of these drugs, have a conversation with them about the potential for abuse.
Mm-hmm. And the next one is about a very common drug called, or the category of drugs called statins, and also about a really common disease of gallstone disease.
Yeah, you know, statins over the years have gotten kind of bad publicity at times.
And good publicity.
But everyone's got an opinion about them. You know, they swear they wouldn't take them. They swear that they do take them. But
they think they should put them in the water.
Yeah, don't dump
them
out.
We'd all live longer.
Don't dump them out in the toilet. But, you know, this is some very interesting research on perhaps some benefit if you are taking a statin. It's probably not a reason to take it, but some benefit about reduction in gallstone disease. Not a fun thing to have.
So they looked at, they investigated how statins or what sort of relationship these medicines have to gallstones. They looked at 1.7 million people in Denmark.
Yeah, this is our Denmark colleagues here.
I know.
They're doing some pretty good research out there.
They are good researchers. And what they found is that people who had at least 5 prescriptions for these medicines, meaning they were taking it on a longer term basis.
Not taking all 5 of them at the same
time.
No,
but had been on them at least for 5 months.
Yes.
That the risk of developing gallstones fell by 11 to 24%. And the more prescriptions you were on, like the longer you'd been taking it, the larger the decrease in your risk to get gallstones.
Yeah. And this was actually in the American Journal of Epidemiology. And it does make sense because these statins can reduce the makeup, the synthesis of cholesterol so that you don't excrete as much cholesterol in the liver, and that would decrease your risk of gallstones. And, you know, for a lot of people, they will end up getting gallstones, and that is surgery, and you will be out of work, and actually, people have complications from this. So this is not a benign disease if we can prevent it. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's just fascinating, a potential other benefit to
it. And the only other way that I know of really is to cut down on your alcohol use mm-hmm. and to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some other ways that we know of. Well, Christy, that's some pretty interesting research that we've been able to review today, not only about gallstones and statins, but also teens and dangerous prescriptions.
And about internet programs to help decrease alcohol intake, and a little bit about the suicide risk after having a heart attack.
Let's make interventions that help people live healthier lives and prevent some of these illnesses.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Amelia Drake about ears, tonsils, and sinus infections in children. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy and I are very excited to be able to have a conversation about ears, tonsils, and sinus infection in children. And as we were talking about at the top of the show, Christy, I know that you deal with these kinds of problems with your own children. I dealt with my children. I think this is every parent's nightmare and headaches about raising children.
Well, and especially in the winter season, this is a timely topic. We would like to welcome Dr. Amelia Drake, Chief of the Division of Pediatric Otolaryngology at UNC, a real specialist in ear, nose, and throat, and in all the things we're talking about today. Dr. Drake, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
You know, I know that you've been at UNC for quite some time and you're a very committed clinician and a teacher, but we'd love to hear about your story and how you became really passionate about taking care of these issues in kids.
Right. So I have been practicing for some years now, and my father, Newton Fisher, was an otolaryngologist, still just not practicing anymore, but was a huge influence on my interest. And when I finished, I saw the area of pediatric otolaryngology as an area that of specialty that hadn't previously really been claimed very much until about maybe 20, 25 years ago. And so when I finished my training, I ended a fellowship in this area. And so try to address the problems that children come in with, particularly from a specialist standpoint, with a certain common sense. Saving surgery and even x-rays until sort of when they are thought to be really needed.
Well, you know, this is such a common issue that affects parents and children. And I guess actually one of the questions I have is why are ear infections, for instance, so common in kids? Why is that? Why is the anatomy made that way?
So I don't know that there's a why on this type of thing, but I guess I think of it a little bit not only an anatomic feature because the face is small, as you know, the head is small when it comes out the womb, and then it has a normal enormous amount of growth as the brain and neurologic functions develop, as do the sinuses and all our, you know, and our eustachian tubes. And so probably part of it's anatomic, the eustachian tubes being more horizontally located at birth.
And those are the tubes that connect your ear, the inner part of your ear and your throat?
Right.
How do you explain it to people when you're talking about eustachian tubes?
Right. So I just try to talk about what they do, how we all yawn and can clear. And most people can relate to clearing your middle ears, either on an airplane trip or a trip to the mountains, whereas children can't do that as effectively. And part of that's a structural reason.
And so a lot of kids get ear infections. They go to their family doctor or pediatrician. Parents are expecting antibiotics because we were given those when we were children. And I know there's been a lot of controversy over the years about whether or not antibiotics are even helpful. I think it was last week or the week before, Adam and I talked about some recent research coming out about the difference between giving an antibiotic versus not on a population level. But what's your take on that from a primary care standpoint about antibiotics for your routine ear infections of children?
So I think that many of us that see a lot of ear disease like you all and we do, and of course the pediatricians, almost think of ear disease in children as a like a bad thing they have to get over to build immunity, and it's just going to happen. To heavier infections as a child is more common than not, almost, because the prevalence is very high. And I'm not probably answering your question because you were referring more to where's the role of antibiotics?
But yeah, I'll the just, virus versus the bacteria.
Yeah, I'll just say that part of this is a cultural, you know, we're very, our expectations from our patients are much more perhaps demanding of immediate wellness, whereas other cultures seem more content to avoid antibiotics. And their side effects. We in this country, and I don't know if it's because we have more daycare or more just higher expectations for wellness, we want to see our children treated and made well quickly, even if that isn't always the best philosophy.
Well, it's clear that, you know, that antibiotics can help. It's also clear that a large majority of infections are viral. And I guess one of the things that, and Christy and I even kind of came down a little bit on different sides sometimes about how you have a conversation. How do you have that conversation with your own patients? Because it seems like you could come down on potentially viewing this from both different sides.
I guess the way I look at that is trying to have a family understand what's best for their child. And everyone wants what's best for their child. And so if you portray the antibiotic as having some risk, which we don't always do, I mean, sometimes it's just easier to write that out.
It's so true. It's easier to write it than to talk to the parents.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we try to say it's not going to do them a lick of good, or if we're talking about x-rays, which is going to be the bigger issue when we get to the sinus part, you know, it's not going to, that adds radiation. And you see how people are concerned about radiation in the terminals and the airports. And so people sort of, they understand it. They understand the risk. They just need to be pointed out that their children are, you know, also at risk.
Well, and usually by the time these children get to you in your specialty clinic, they've had several ear infections and they've had a persistent problem that either wasn't getting better with the treatment course with their doctor or was happening so frequently that the thought is maybe they needed what we call PE tubes or an intervention to help help the ears drain. Can you talk a little bit about when you recommend tubes for children?
Yeah, so clearly we're interested not just in the number of times they need an antibiotic, and I agree. I usually start that conversation by telling a family member that we don't have any new antibiotics that their doctor doesn't have. So we all use the same group of antibiotics, the same classes of antibiotics, and if they're not working anymore, we don't have any something new up our sleeve.
You don't have that lucky charm.
Right. But the tubes, I think we bring that in if the child's so often on antibiotics that we perceive that in itself as a risk.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, really we throw the hearing issue into it. So mm-hmm. we usually start by checking their hearing.
And talk about that. How often does ear infections, I mean, what does it take to really affect the hearing? Can one ear infection do it?
It certainly can, and there are probably times that people's hearing is off a little bit, but unless you catch it, you know, catch a time that they may have middle ear fluid and test them at that moment, you may not realize in a toddler that their hearing might fluctuate. So fluctuating hearing may be more accurate, at least in a toddler. And as long as they're mostly coming along and their speech is developing, that's not a problem. But if they're keeping middle ear fluid so much, and I think the recommendations developed were over 4 months at a time, then certainly we would start to offer tubes if hearing is being compromised.
Just because that would be most of the time or a large proportion of the time that they're really not hearing well.
And it's during the critical time that they're trying to develop speech.
Yeah, wow.
And I just last thing before we maybe take a break, but mention just tube surgery. How often does it work, and what are the risks?
So first, let's start with anesthesia for the tube surgery. It's not what people think of put on a ventilator and protecting the airway. It's really just a little mask, blow-by type of inhalational approach, and I'm not saying it doesn't have risk. But the risk is relatively minimal. So the child's breathing throughout. usually they don't even get an IV. They just get a little whiff of the inhalational agent to hold still long enough for us to bring a microscope in and put the tubes in. So it takes literally a few minutes on each side. So there is some risk both with the anesthetic and the fact that the tube itself can introduce infection. So if the child's underwater a lot or just continues to get bad colds, that causes drainage to the out of the tubes, a family may not perceive that as an improvement.
Well, we do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Amelia Drake. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You've been listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Amelia Drake about ears and tonsils and sinus infections in children. And we did a really nice job. Dr. Drake did a nice job about talking about ear infections. Christy and I just kind of asked questions. But we really wanted to also move into talking a little bit about tonsils infections. And Dr. Drake, I know that when my son was 8 years old, he had his tonsils out because he was getting lots of infections, and he was snoring loudly and not sleeping good. And I was a little ambivalent because I was being brought up to believe as a provider that maybe we were doing too many of these. But I can tell you, it made a huge difference in his life and our family's quality of life since then. What kind of stories do you have about tonsils?
Well, I have a number of stories now that you ask.
I'm sure you do.
And I'll start just with my own. My own son was getting recurrent strep at 7 or 8, and that seems to be when the child hits the school years. I mean, we accept a couple of episodes when they're young, and we figure they need to see the strep to build immunity to it. And he would get the classic scarlet fever with a blush over the truncal rash. And I thought, surely he shouldn't have his tonsils out just because his mom takes out tonsils for her life, you know, for her job, her career. And
that's a conflict.
I thought that I didn't want to push him in that direction, so I held off, treated him medically. And as he was going through high school, he had to quit the track and field club. He was just sick all the time. And finally, at 18, just before heading off to college last summer, he had his tonsils out by one of my colleagues. So it shows that we don't always outgrow our tonsil infections.
And did it help him?
Oh, dramatically. Dramatically. If a child's continuing to get tonsillitis and you remove the tonsils, most of them do better. Now, it doesn't help every sore throat, as you know.
Well, and we learned a lot about removing tonsils for frequent strep infections, as you mentioned. But then, you know, there seems to be more and more out about sleep apnea in children, about the adenoids being big, about whether or not to take out both the tonsils and the adenoids. Since you're there, you might as well just take out the adenoids too. And just a lot of differences in opinions on how aggressive we should be with removing tonsils and adenoids. What's your take on that?
I think that conservatism is always appropriate when we're talking about young children and removing tissue that they were born with that's non-neoplastic.
And meaning not cancer.
That's not cancerous, and it's there to help them fight infections. And that said, as we've been able to treat strep and strep illnesses and other infections of the throat that were historically more prevalent, sleep apnea appears to be the issue that children present with. And part of that is recognition, recognizing that children do need to stay alert to learn at school and that some of the attention issues in young children may be related to poor sleep.
Well, you know, it was interesting in my case. I don't know how common this is, but I traveled with my son for tennis tournaments a lot, and we'd have in the same hotel room, and he would snore so loud we couldn't, you know, and he would also be kind of jerking around in bed all night. And in retrospect, he probably had some sleep apnea, and it really made a huge difference. Not only did he really doesn't snore anymore, which we all sleep better, the jerkiness kind of went down. And I don't know if it's cause and effect, but it sure seemed like it after the adenoids were out and tonsils, it got better.
And we don't recommend a sleep study on every child because I think that is a pricey way to go through medicine to look at huge tonsils that are obviously causing some problem and say, oh, we need to study this further. I mean, I would say that we all want to be smart about what we recommend, but probably had you studied him, there would have been an element of arousals and wakefulness that was associated with hypopnea or mini partial obstructions at night.
Well, it's not always that clear. Y'all have both talked about your children, so of course I have to chime in now. But my daughter is 5, and she snores really loudly at night. She did have some sinus infection type stuff earlier on, but nothing enough to really hang your hat on. And I really think she's got that in some way she might benefit from surgery for her tonsils and adenoids. I don't want to be the doctor who's like, you know, pushing surgery on a child. And she doesn't meet, like, she hasn't had strep throat or, you know, anything like that. So
sometimes
it's just not so clear.
What would you recommend for Christy's child? We're going to get her an unofficial consult here.
Well, I should
bring her in.
I think sometimes a sleep study is helpful when we're not sure. And we as parents don't want to over-diagnose our children. So that may be a, you know, if it's continuing or if you see some consequences by day.
Yeah, I mean, tired all the time.
Well, that could be then something that may benefit her. And a study would help show that. I mean, the sleep studies didn't used to be very good, but they're very good now. The UNC sleep lab, Dr. Brad Vaughn, is involved with most of the children's sleep studies, and that's a very good study.
We're talking with Dr. Amelia Drake, chief of the Division of Pediatric Otolaryngology, or otherwise known as ENT, ear, nose, and throat at UNC. And Dr. Drake, in addition to Dr. Paige and yourself getting your children treated when they're much too old.
Over-treating or under-treating?
Younger. Tell us a little bit about sinus problems, though, in children, because I do think this is one of those things that I'm not so even certain that I'm using the best evidence-based knowledge about how often sinus infections occur in children and what do we know about their treatment both with or without antibiotics.
So again, I think many times the sinuses mirror the ear disease but in a little bit of an older child. So there's an anatomic issue because the sinuses are small and the osteomedial, the area that drains the sinuses into the nose, are physically small and sometimes inflamed by a cold or allergy. But there's also an immunity that's developing in the early years. Now, most doctors historically would brush off the parent who said, "Doc, I think my child has sinusitis," by saying, "Oh, no, your child's much too small to have sinuses." And we've been proven wrong with better imaging techniques. So now we recognize that even babies are born with very small little maxillary and ethmoid sinuses that develop over time, and then the frontals, the ones in the forehead, really develop by about 12. So again, in terms of the overall look at children and when to intervene, I personally think that we try medical therapy first, and obviously not for the first sign of a runny nose, because that's probably viral, and so most of my colleagues will wait 7 to 10 days and call it a virus or a common cold, and that at 2 weeks later start to entertain the diagnosis of sinusitis. But last, I wanted to say that we don't really recommend surgery or imaging unless this is a recurrent and ongoing problem requiring missed days of school and the like, and then there is a lot more that can be done very safely.
Well, it sounds like you take a very family-centered, conservative approach to
almost like a family doc.
I know.
We may have to give you an honorary degree in our department. But can I ask you one question that does come up? We and the adults that we see, I have been. I don't know about you, Christy, but I've been recommending kind of like a neti pot or some sort of sinus irrigation. Is that ever beneficial for children, or the role of kind of some saline or other salt water irrigation for children?
Bulb syringe.
So I think nasal hygiene is incredibly helpful if you can
nasal
get
hygiene.
That's what we call it.
I like that. I like that.
If you can get someone to use it, I think it's very helpful. Whether that's just saline in the very young child or occasional use of very low dose nasal decongestant drops in the older child or preteen, just with the head cold, that can be helpful in terms of clearing the infection. topically clearing thing.
Oh, that is really good advice. You know, Dr. Drake, we are so happy to have a chance to talk with you today and grateful that you've come on the show to give some really important perspective for our listeners.
Well, thank you.
Well, we're going to need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be entertaining your calls. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Calls segment, we're going to take some of your listener questions and hear about your experiences.
And how, Christy, can people send us any comments they want to send us?
Lots of ways. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 966-8081 and leave your question.
Well, and let's listen to our very first House Call today. What's on your mind?
Hi, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about body mass index and why is so much importance placed on it? And it seems to be that so much importance is placed on it, especially with health insurance companies and so forth, and other variables such as bone density, although that may or may not have as much importance, and you know, muscle mass and fat content on your body as a picture of overall health. Why is it that body mass index is there's so much importance placed on it?
That is a really, really good question, and one that's that I think a lot of people want to know. Like, what is this BMI or body mass index, and why does it matter so much to doctors and, I mean, as you say, even to insurance companies?
Well, and you know, doctors weren't uniformly trained in this until probably much more recently. We used to not really pay attention to this. We paid attention really just to people's weight and looking at, you know, were they overweight or underweight. But then we realize that it also has to take into account how big their bones are and how big they are. It's not just their weight.
So the BMI, or body mass index, is this number that gets calculated based on a person's weight and height. And it's a pretty reliable indicator of body fatness and for most people. So if you're over 25, you're considered overweight. And if you're over 30, you're considered obese. And what we know is that this BMI of being overweight or obese puts you at higher risk for developing certain medical problems.
Yeah, you know, all kinds of things ranging from the arthritis to diabetes. And what's interesting also is I had a patient, Christy, the other day who said they were really overweight. And I said, well, you know, your body mass index, your BMI, it was, you know, 23. And, you know, they weighed 150 pounds. And so I think the perception sometimes is that they're more, the weight is really the big issue in terms of health. Now, they may have wanted to lose weight for other reasons. But health-wise, I said, your weight's perfect.
Right. And other people who think, well, I have big bones or I'm really look just like everyone else in my family, but yet you're telling me that this number says that I'm obese and that doesn't make sense. And part of that's because most of America, I mean, it's an epidemic now that there's so much obesity that in some ways it skews how we see it.
Yeah. If you're 4 feet, 4 inches and you weigh 150 pounds, your body mass index is probably going to be, in 150 pounds, you might be a body mass index too high. But if you were that same weight and you were close to 6 feet, you would be on the very low end of the body mass index. So it really does depend. To have a conversation with your doctor, thank you so much for that question. What's our very next House Call question from our listener today?
In controlling type 2 diabetes by diet, what advice do you all have about trying to avoid any heart disease and all the other things, because I end up eating a lot of protein and a little bit higher fat than I think I would otherwise.
Thank you for asking that question. It's really tough for a lot of people with diabetes to figure out the best way to eat that really is in the best interest of their diabetes and also their overall health.
But you know what? Thank you for asking for our advice. You were going to get it one way or the other. And we do have a lot of advice on this, because this is one of those things that we think that can be not only controlled, it really could almost be cured. A lot of people can really have diabetes that doesn't impact their lives if they take the right steps.
And one step that I'll just put out there is to meet with a nutritionist to really help have someone tailor what you're eating and how much you are exercising and your overall situation of health and come up with a diet that works for you. So that's one piece of advice.
And a lot of people will end up really needing to lose weight. A lot of people really need to cut down on the amount of carbohydrates they're eating, because those are kind of big, bad things for people with diabetes a lot of times. But these are pretty complicated discussions. I like that idea about meeting with a dietitian, nutritionist. How do they do that?
Well, usually your doctor can just make a referral, and most insurance companies, particularly if you already have diabetes, will cover the cost for you to see a nutritionist. I mean, a lot of times the focus is on some weight loss, a lower calorie diet, and trying to eat foods that are maybe higher in fiber or whole grain types of foods instead of those like real quick sugars like white breads and candies and those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well,
but it is pretty complicated, so we do wish you the best.
Good, simple advice. And speaking of which, let's see what our very next house call is today.
Hi, I am a 25-year-old student, and my grandmother recently went to the hospital after having some heart palpitations, and she was told she had atrial fibrillation, and I was just wondering what that meant.
Good question, huh?
It is a good question. I think it's amazing how many people get diagnoses in their family or even in themselves, and either for whatever reason, the doctors didn't communicate clearly of what exactly that means. It's a big word, atrial fibrillation.
Well, and what's interesting also is that, you know, heart palpitations, that's a big fancy word as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the heart just kind of beating a little bit. And
we
have to assume this case that your grandmother, not only did she feel it beating abnormally, may have had some other symptoms. Because a lot of people, if their heart's just kind of beating extra beat or two, we don't end up going to the emergency room. We may go see our doctor. So maybe she had some shortness of breath. Maybe she had some chest pain, some other symptoms that got her concerned. But certainly we're glad that she did.
And in terms of your question of what is atrial fibrillation, it is an irregular heartbeat that can happen from like an abnormal part of your heart that sort of triggers an extra signal for it to beat. And so it's kind of beating sometimes out of sync. It's not real ba-bump, 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 but it can be sort of all over the place in terms of how
it
beats.
Say that again, Kristy. Ba-bump, ba-bump. No, that's good. This is a hard thing to describe over to our listeners. One way I say it is sometimes, and you can make fun of me, is this balloon, and take a balloon that normally contracts and then opens up and contracts, and the balloon just kind of doesn't contract. It just kind of sits there and just kind of
quivers.
Quivers. Yeah, but it doesn't. It either way, it reduces the efficiency. Your heart, it does not quite as efficient as it should be.
And sometimes that means you have other heart disease. And so in this case, hopefully the doctors who were taking care of your grandmother investigated, maybe with an ultrasound of looking at her heart, and put her on certain medications that can be helpful, because it does put you at a higher risk of stroke. So there are medicines that can help prevent that.
Hope she's doing well. And our very last house call today, what do you have for us?
I have a question about vitamin D. Everyone in my family's taking it. Both my parents are taking it because they've been told their vitamin D is low. And I'm wondering, should I be taking it? How much of it should I be taking? What would you tell your patients about that?
Vitamin D. Well, we don't have a lot of time,
vitamin
Kristy.
Du jour.
And this is changing, too. There's really some interesting research that we have to talk about in the future, I think future show coming up, about some problems with a lot of the supplementation. But for you, we can probably get some quick answers.
Yes. So vitamin D, there is research that it can help prevent falls in the elderly, that it's good for bone health, particularly in the elderly, and maybe some immune properties as well. So a lot of people take it. I tell my patients there's a tolerable upper intake level that's published by a lot of organizations of 2,000 international units daily, unless your doctor tells you otherwise.
Yeah. And should you be taking it? Well, probably not unless a doctor tells you should be taking it. And that really needs to be some testing that's done. And try, if you could, to get it in dietary ways. If that doesn't work and you're at risk, you know, a supplement is certainly possible. But that's probably all we can talk about today. But certainly, hopefully, a little bit about vitamin D and atrial fibrillation.
A little bit about type 2 diabetes and diet, and a little bit about the BMI.
Body mass index. There you go.
So thank you guys for giving us some house calls today and for being with us for your health. We hope we've addressed some things that are important to you. And we want you to write us, contact us, share your experiences and your thoughts about the program.
And we want to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, and our guest today, Dr. Amelia Drake.
And on behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Kristy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.